Welcome, everybody, to this LSE Ideas discussion and debate on a very big, important topic, not only if you live in Asia, but around the world. And this is really as much a book launch as a debate. And so congratulations to my old colleague and friend from LSE and now at Yale, Professor Ordani Westad, the Engelsberg Chair this year in History and International Relations at LSE Ideas, for his new book, wonderful title on the Empire and Righteous Nation. I think I know which one is the empire and which one is the righteous nation, thinking about the relationship past and present between China and Korea. So Arnie, great to welcome you again. Great to be chairing you again. Now, part of my whole life is chairing and having discussions with you, carrying on what we started in the Cold War Studies Center back in 2004. But good to see you again. I'd also like to extend a very, very warm LSE welcome, Ideas welcome, to Dr. Jim Hoare at SOAS and an old friend, Rosemary Foote, who I've known for very many years at Oxford University. So this is absolutely fantastic debate we're going to have. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details of all the speakers. They should be pretty well known to you all. Jim has written on Korean politics. Rosemary has written extensively on China. And Arnie, of course, has written not only on the Cold War China, but also, of course, on this new topic, which I think, Arnie, was a series of lectures that you gave. And, you know, it's going to be wonderful to hear this. So we're going to simply set it out in the following way. I'm going to ask Professor Westad, Arnie Westad, to first go, 10 minutes or so, Arnie, just to outline the main themes in your book on the China-Korean relation and why it's so significant even today. It has a long historical root, of course, going back centuries, but why it still remains so crucial today. I'm then going to ask Jim Hoare, who's a research associate at the Center of Korean Studies at SOAS, to kind of reflect on some of the arguments and themes developed by Arnie. I know you've already written a review about this already, Jim, but looking forward to hearing your comments. And then Rosemary again to reflect on the current, maybe on the current situation as much as on history. So with no further ado, Arnie, I'm gonna hand it over to you. The hashtag for this event is hashtag LSE China Korea. And please tweet us at LSE Ideas. So Arnie, no further ado, much looking forward to what you have to say. Arnie, over to you.
Thanks, Mick. It's always a pleasure to be chaired by Mick Cox. We know the chairing will be enthusiastic and it will make sure that things proceed right on time. So that's the great thing about having a prominent LSE intellectual as the chair of this setting. Also, really grateful to Jim Hoare and Rosemary Foote that they could come in and comment on this little book, because it is actually a small book that I have done on China and Korea, roughly since the end of the 14th century. I'll explain why the 14th century in a moment. But first, I should note that the book came out of a set of lectures I gave now 3 years ago at Harvard in a series that is called the Rush Hour Lectures. And it just so happens that I was commenting on the first of the Rush Hour Lectures given by Professor Rana Mitter at Oxford, virtually at Harvard yesterday. So this is a very interesting series of lectures. Quite a number of books have come out of them over the past 35 years. And the one that I chose is on China and Korea, going back to the 14th century. The reason why I picked China and Korea, I think, should be pretty obvious. The conflict on the Korean Peninsula is one of the most important, one of the most frightening of the international conflicts that we have in the world today. Not just because of the situation with the North Korean nuclear weapons, but also because it is a leftover from the Cold War era that is still unresolved. And it's really holding the whole region, possibly the whole world back, in terms of searching for security in the 21st century. So a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, a military conflict, a war, would have repercussions even for us in Britain and the United States that it's really hard to contemplate the framework of. So it is important. And I thought it would be really interesting to look at this particular relationship in a long-term perspective. Because China, whatever way you think about the current Chinese government and its international affairs, China is going to have a very significant influence on any resolution, both to the North Korean nuclear problem, but also, I hope, to the resolution of the bigger problem, which is the very artificial divide of the Korean Peninsula or Korea into two separate states. So I dedicated this book to the peaceful and united Korea of the future. I'm pretty sure that it will come, but the circumstances under which it is created will be of great significance for all of us. So why start it in the 14th century? Well, the main reason is that even though there had been relationships, connections between China and what we know today as Korea going much further back in time, this is the moment when both of them, for slightly different reasons, start a very new political project, which is based on Neo-Confucian thinking about the individual, about society, and about the state. You could call it a Neo-Confucian revolution. The Ming Empire takes over in China roughly at that time, and the Joseon state, the new kingdom that is established in Korea, also comes into being roughly at the same time in the late 14th century. And both of them are intensely preoccupied with this ideological transformation that is related to Neo-Confucian thinking. So let me talk a little bit about Neo-Confucianism. So the Peter Bull, my old friend and colleague, expert on Confucianism, among many other things, on China in the medieval era, once said to me that Neo-Confucianism is Confucianism for human beings. And there is much to be said for that summary. Confucianism is a view of the world that stretches back a very long time, as you will know. It has a lot of different preoccupations, different aspects of the world that it's interested in. What the Neo-Confucians do about 1,000 years ago is that they try to put this together in a set of rules and recommendations for how human beings should lead their lives and how society and the state should be organized in order to enable people to live the best possible lives. It's a very hierarchical form of thinking. Everyone has their place among individuals, families, and the state. But it's also built on a set of rights and obligations. It's hierarchical in terms of decisions, but it's also very involved. Everyone has their place within the state. Everyone also has the right to be heard within the state, but at the level that they are at. That, I think, is a reasonable summary of what the Neo-Confucian revolution in the late 14th century was all about. And this is what brought China and Korea closely together, because both of these countries, and no other country at this particular point in time, take over the in-depth sense of Neo-Confucian ideology and tries to build new kinds of states based on it. The Koreans, perhaps even more so than the people who lived in China, lived in the Ming Empire at that time. The Koreans during the Joseon era, which goes from the late 14th century and all the way up to the beginning of the 20th century, are very preoccupied. The elite is very preoccupied with what you could call Neo-Confucian rectitude. So some of my students here at Yale have been saying, so why didn't you call it empire and empire and the rectitude of nations, or something along those lines, incorporating not just Korea, but also the international system. And the reason why I didn't use the term rectitude, but rather righteousness, is that that is the way that the Neo-Confucian framework has been understood in Korea I think, all the way up to our own day, not as a kind of system that is created that people simply have to obey, because rectitude sort of indicates a rather barren kind of system that you have to adhere to. It is more the living principle of righteousness, including righteousness as regards Korea's place in the world, that has become the slogan of all slogans for these forms of neo-Confucian thinking. So whenever Korea in the past have been attacked, have been exploited, have been attempted colonized by the Japanese in the 20th century, every single occasion, there are groups, movements, armies that appear among Koreans calling themselves righteous, using that term to say that they are right, they are correct under the kind of interstate relationships and historical relationships that is created by the Neo-Confucian past. I don't mean to indicate that Koreans by nature are more righteous than other people. But I do want to say that that is a slogan that has been much used, particularly against the empire, particularly against whatever empire has been in charge in China. By being more righteous than the Chinese, the Korean state has been able to survive and hold its own, even against a very, very powerful neighbor. So the first chapter in the book deals with this and sets up the framework from the late 14th century and up to the end of the 19th century. The second part of the book then deals with the 20th century in what I call the internationalization of East Asia. So for most people within this region, but maybe particularly for Koreans, because they have been relatively isolated from the rest of the world under Chinese tutelage, the sudden advent of a new kind of international order in East Asia was a real shock to the system. First the Western powers, and then the Japanese, in terms of Japan's expansion from the late 19th century on. And Korea could, I think, rightly be seen as the primary victim of much of what was happening during this time period. So Korea was first broken away from its close alliance, close relationship with China, with the Qing Empire of that time, and then gradually forced to come under predominance and then direct colonization by Japan, which is, I think, the formative aspect of Korean history as seen from today. The fact that just when what we would call a modern form of nationalism, of Korean identity, was arising in Korea, just at that very moment, Korea was colonized from the outside. And these nationalisms therefore had to develop and to thrive in many ways in exile. And there is nothing as intense as a nationalism that has developed in exile. So we see this both with the guys who are holding power in North Korea now, Korean communism developing from the early 20th century on, but we also see it in the South, very much connected to the history of what became the Korean War, the US intervention, and the close relationship with the United States that developed both before the war and after the Korean War. The Korean War, I should say, is the dividing line in many ways in terms of the conflict on the Korean Peninsula. I don't have time to go into the history of the Korean War now, but that was one of the most interesting aspects of writing the book, was to try to figure out both the antecedents of the war, where the war came from, but also the effects that the very negative, very destructive effects that the war had, not just for Korea, but for Eastern Asia in general and for the world in terms of the militarization of the Cold War. And then the final chapter in the book, the third chapter, deals with China and Korea today. So again, some of my colleagues here like to joke that the first chapter deals with about 600 years or 500 years of Sino-Korean relation. The second chapter deals with 100 years of Sino-Korean relations, and the third chapter deals with about 2 weeks of Sino-Korean relations. That's not quite true. It's some time now since I wrote this, so at least it deals with a couple of years of China-Korea relations. what I try to do in it is to talk a little bit about how the past influences the possibilities that are there today, both for a decrease in tension on the Korean Peninsula, but also more long-term for reunification. And in that picture, understanding these distinct forms of Korean nationalism play a very important part. My view is that outside powers cannot create a better future from Korea. It would only come from within, but it has to be facilitated by outside powers, and first and foremost by China. To put it very bluntly, the main reason today why we have the kind of situation that we have on the peninsula, of course, has to do with the internal circumstances in terms of political rivalries in Korea. But it's also pretty clear that if it hadn't been for China's support for the North, its willingness, in spite of many provocations from North Korea and a lot of dissonance and disagreement between Beijing and Pyongyang, if it hadn't been for the People's Republic of China's willingness to sustain the North Korean regime, it almost certainly would not have been here anymore. We can talk in the Q&A, I hope, about the reasons why China even today are willing to sustain a regime that so obviously has very little in common with in North Korea. But it's clear that China today sees this in a much broader international perspective. It's increasingly being connected to the rivalry between the United States and China. So even if China today, a little bit like back in the late 14th century, have much more in common with the part of Korea that is forward-looking, that is productive, that is successful, which now means the South, it's still very, very careful with breaking up a pattern of allegiance and a pattern of connection that has developed over a long period of time, particularly as China itself, so its leaders claim, are coming under increasing international pressure, particularly from the United States, in terms of China's overall rise. So this is a very brief summary, Mick, of what this book is about. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what Jim and Rosemary have to say.
Well, thanks, China. Thanks, Arnie. The emphasis on China is pretty self-evident, isn't it? I mean, you could even extend your argument at the very end. It's not just the present regime which is sustained by China. The regime would not have actually been saved during the Korean War without Chinese intervention. I think it's pretty obvious. The Americans would have reached the Yalu River and North Korea have been reunified under different terms. So the Chinese factor in all this is absolutely vital, as you say. Much to talk about there, Arnie, Neo-Confucianism. You didn't mention Japan. I'd be interested to hear some of your views on Korean views on Japan. There is another complicating factor. However, it's not up to me. It's over to you, Jim, to reflect on China, on Arnie's book, and indeed give us some of your own thoughts, because you are one of the very few Korean specialists in the UK today. So really looking forward to what you have to say.
Thank you. The late lamented Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea, used to say that anybody who says they're a Korean expert is a fool. So it's not a term I choose to use. I know something about the place. I've lived in both the South and in the North as a diplomat, and I've lived also in China. And that, to a certain extent, has always influenced my thinking about the peninsula and its relationships. I agree entirely with what's been said about the importance of China. It's true that if China had not intervened in 1950, North Korea would have disappeared. It's equally true that if the United States hadn't intervened in 1950, South Korea might well have disappeared. The chances of South Korea, although it was bigger in terms of population and people on its own, being able to resist the armed North, which was very differently armed from what the South was, it's impossible to think of. I mean, the North Koreans had conquered, not thoroughly, but held most of the country by the autumn of 1950. So, but you can't go back. The concern with China, the involvement with China, is very strong and always has been in both Koreas. Doesn't mean to say they like each other, but it does mean to say that each takes account of the other. China matters to both of them. Even during the time I lived in South Korea, when Chun Doo-hwan was president, when the old military system was still in existence, China still fascinated them. And I first actually went to Korea, to South Korea, in 1976. I flew in, having just visited Beijing, my first visit to Beijing as well. And I was held at the airport because I had a Chinese visa in my passport. Fortunately, I was good friends with the then head of the KCIA in London, and he'd already cleared the ground for me, so I was allowed in. But the fascination was what I had seen in China. China dominated a lot of the conversations I had. I was invited to military headquarters, thinking I would just have a chat with some researcher, the same sort of level as I was. Instead, I went into a room that was dripping with gold lace, general upon general, and even higher, if you can get anything higher, sat there. And they asked me all about China. My host, who was a very senior officer, waved down one gentleman who wanted to leave the room. No, no, you had to stay and hear about China. And the fascination with China when I was in South Korea was equally strong. Koreans, North and South, are in a strange sort of psychological way, I think, very dependent on China. That long historical involvement, which Anne has dealt with the latter period of it. But as I've tried to say in my review, that the involvement goes on 1,000 years before the advent of the Ming and the advent of the Joseon dynasty. And that period is very important because it was a very formative period in relationship. It made quite clear to the Koreans that they had to be on good terms with China, but they had to take account of the big neighbor, whatever you call it. Sometimes it's not China, it's something else. But that north of them, there is a big, vast neighbor with easy access by land. So they have to take account of it. And they do, and they did take account of it. As I say, there is no love lost, I think, in this relationship. There's a great admiration for things Chinese, but essentially they have resented over the years the attempts by the Chinese court or the Chinese state to tell Koreans what to do. Koreans don't like being told what to do. But you see it all around you in those two countries, North and South Korea. And they are now, despite what Arnie says about one day being reunified, it's not going to be easy. I've always said it will be not till after I'm dead. And unfortunately, that's getting nearer and nearer. So it might happen rather sooner than expected. But I don't think that the task will be an easy one. They have grown very much apart in some ways, but not, curiously enough, in that relationship with China. You would be very surprised how many Korean officials, North Korean officials, speak good Chinese, but they rarely let on that they speak good Chinese. They rarely let on that they have studied in China. Some of you may know the name of Tae Yong-ho, who used to be the number two in the North Korean embassy here in London, who for many years was very much my opposite number when I was dealing with the North Koreans, both in London and in Pyongyang. Mr. Tae spoke beautiful Chinese. He'd studied in Beijing. He never admitted it until we had the then chief clerk of the Foreign Office, who visited to formally open the embassy that I had set up. And they'd been told that he spoke Chinese. So two of them in the car coming away from the airport started talking to him in Chinese just to test how good he was. And afterwards they said, he's not bad. But Mr. Tay never told me he could speak Chinese. In all sorts of ways too, they both distance themselves and want to know China, want to be involved with China. In another context, you might call it the bandwagon system. A small state faced by a large state tries to get on with it and deal with it. And that applies to South Korea as well. The South Koreans never really found Taiwan a satisfactory alternative to the great empire, which was still to the north of them, even though there was a barrier in between. They wanted a proper relationship with China. And they were very, despite all the anti-communist propaganda, that sort of relationship began in a very tentative way under Park Chung-hee towards the latter part of his period in power. It carried on under Chen Zhuhuan. There was trade going on. There were other sorts of contacts as well. By the time I was in Beijing in the late 1980s, I began to find myself running into old friends from Korea, South Korea. No relation between them, but there was the Minister for Small and Medium Industries in Beijing, in the Forbidden City. Somebody else I met on the Great Wall. People I'd known and worked with when I'd been in Seoul. So the relationship was being cemented and tied together. And it was very easy by the time 1992 came for them to actually complete it. I will talk a little bit about the book. Don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the book very much. I thought it was extremely well written, and I think it covers most of the main points. But I do think that half an hour before the 600 years that makes up the previous relationship might have had a bit more coverage, because I think it still does resonate within North Korea, within South Korea. Just before Arne joined us, I was saying how if I'd realized the literary review did illustrations, I'd have put in a picture of one of the royal tombs at Kaesong, now in the north, previously for a brief period in the south, but captured during the Korean War and never regained. There's a very nice tomb which Kim Il-sung had restored. Fairly tastefully. Not all of his restorations or his son's restorations are tasteful, but this was quite well done. And the why I would have put it in is because it has the Korean tiger, various strategic points around the tomb, but it also has the Mongolian sheep, because the Mongols were the rulers of China at the time, and they had imposed a rule on the Koreans that they had to send a bride for certain imperial personages to Beijing. And to mark this, the tomb shows that relationship. The sheep are as beautifully restored as the tigers, I can assure you. So I did enjoy the book. I do recommend it. I think for anybody coming fresh to the subject who wants a good, clear account of what is a very complex and often confusing relationship, they will find it in this book. But I would hope that having found that and used that as their key, they go back a bit further into the detail. And, you know, I'll finish with another anecdote. So I'm not really an academic, I'm a sort of retired diplomat. I come back from the diplomatic shop in Pyongyang, carrying some light bulbs. And the interpreter, the Korean interpreter to the Swedish ambassador, we share the Swedish embassy premises, as they were then. They're now the German embassy premises. His interpreter said to me, "What have you got there?" It's pretty obvious what I'd got there. And I said, "I've got some light bulbs." He said, "Oh, what sort of light bulbs are they? Where were they made?" I said, "Oh, they're made in China." He said, "You shouldn't buy Chinese light bulbs. You should buy Korean light bulbs." I said, "But there aren't any Korean light bulbs." "Oh, you should wait till there are." the other one was, again, Mr. Tay. Some double-decker buses appeared in Pyongyang. Very popular they were, absolutely crammed solid with people, standing upstairs, standing on the stairs. And I said to Mr. Tay, "These are very smart buses from China." He said, "Yes, they're not as good as our Korean buses." Now, most Korean buses carry little stars along the side, representing how many thousands of miles they've traveled. One or two had been to the moon and back. So they were old, decrepit, and always breaking down. But they were better than Chinese buses. Thanks.
Thank you for those reminiscences, Jim. I love the one about the light bulb. It almost sounds Soviet, to be perfectly honest. I have to say, I have visited South Korea, not North Korea. And the issue of nationalism, which you both touched on, is one that struck me enormously when I was in South Korea as well. You touch a very raw nerve very quickly, it seems to me. Whether that's a function of being a small nation or whether it's a function of having a very large neighbor or whether it's a function of Japanese occupation after 1911, I don't know. But it's a fascinating topic. And again, Jim, when you say I'm not really an academic, I genuinely don't believe you, of course. You really are an academic, a public intellectual in the very best sense of the word. So thanks for your great observations. And Rosemary, we'll pass over to you straight away. Rosemary, over to you.
Okay, thanks very much, Nick. In fact, I'd like to thank you, LSE Ideas, and Arnie very much for the opportunity to talk about Arnie's new and impressive book. And I think it's a really thoughtful treatment of a complex historical period. I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliantly succinct and introduces us to so many different themes that I'm going to, of course, and what I'm going to do is contextualize and try and extend some of them. It's not easy to write about such a long period, and it's done in a very accessible way. I'm going to concentrate, Arnie, if that's all right, on the second and the third parts of the book. And as I say, I'd like to contextualize a bit more. I mean, I enjoyed those sections. I enjoyed the second section because I like the intersections about the client, the Qing, and the rituals associated with its authority against this background of a growing Western presence, but also this rise of nationalist sentiment in Japan and Korea, which comes out really strongly. So there's a lot of complexity in the late 19th century, which we show very nicely. And I think it actually, for those of us in IR, I think it demonstrates very nicely that for us to better understand transitions in power and authority, it's not sufficient in any way to embark on this particular phenomenon in terms of dyadic relations, as tends to be the case today with the focus on US-China and whether war is inevitable and all that. The Cynic Order didn't give way easily or neatly to Western imperial intervention. And what you had was these Northeast Asian states straddling in very impressive ways two competing world orders and adopting forms of adaptation, resistance, and often with radically different outcomes. And I think that actually that what your book shows is that if you know, the research that would focus on these complex interactions between the Cynic and the Western systems is actually a very useful point of comparison when we're thinking about systemic transition happening in East Asia today. So thank you very much for that. And that's going to be my theme for the next 5 or so minutes, if that's all right, which is to continue with this transition theme via, first of all, a larger discussion of the implication of the Korean War, which you do touch on, but obviously in just a few pages. And of course, what's important, one of the things, the many things that's important about that war, it's a reason I wrote two books on it, actually, because I saw it as such an important ordering moment in global politics and in regional politics. And one of the major things, of course, is it brings forward, it inserts such a powerful US presence in the Asia Pacific and East Asia in particular. And then I want to say something about the contemporary period, because that powerful US presence is clearly challenged by China, with important implications for the spillover effects on China-Korea relations. So the book touches on the significance of the Korean War. I see that war also as very consequential. It globalized the Cold War and led to this establishment of a forward US position in Asia. So that when you've moved from a position where the United States only has one major commitment, that's with NATO outside of the Western Hemisphere. But by the 1950s, it has something like 450 bases in 36 countries. And military pacts with about 20 other countries outside Latin America. And the United States never looked back from that for the whole of the rest of the period that you discuss in the book. You also talk about the bilateral treaties that emerge as a security framework for the East Asian region or the wider Asia Pacific, the hubs and spokes system that we often talk about. So the Korean War consolidated US ties with South Korea, with Taiwan, with Japan, and of course with other states in Southeast Asia. So and those treaties, of course, that were established in either during the war or immediately after the war with Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, they've been incredibly long lasting. Only the treaty with Taiwan has been ended. And even in this instant, you see the United States still involved via the Taiwan Relations Act, and also by the commitment to continuing to arm Taiwan and to the idea of peaceful resolution of the Chinese Civil War. So we've had this continuity of US presence via hubs and spokes, but without much in the way of connection among the spokes. So bilateralism doesn't help Japan reconcile with its neighbors. East Asia doesn't benefit until more recently from the sort of pacifying role that multilateral international organizations might have played. So even though we talk about Neo-Confucian legacies and all those legacies of the past, there is a powerful alternative framework that's set up that is actually one of division to a large degree. And it's obviously China, Korea, Japan relations to this day are extraordinarily complicated. And in a way, this bilateralism was matched on the communist side, because you have the Sino-Soviet Treaty of Alliance, but only functioning really for about a decade, but nevertheless you had it. And then you had Soviet and Chinese bilateral alliances with North Korea and with communist Vietnam. Now, none of these alliances have been stable or long-lasting, and there hasn't been much, again, that nothing formal, nothing very formal has actually helped to replace that. A really important legacy of the Korean War, of course, has to do with nuclear weapons. And the war is very distinctive because it's one where possible US use of nuclear weapons was debated in Washington, in European capitals. Think about Clement Attlee rushing over to Washington in December 1950. It was debated in Moscow. It was debated in Beijing, Seoul, and Pyongyang. I mean, part of the argument when China considered whether to enter the war revolved around the question of, would the Soviet Union protect China as via their treaty? Would the United States use nuclear weapons? Again, as you mentioned in the book, Eisner and Dulles subsequently came to argue that the nuclear threats issued in 1953 led to the signature of the Armistice Agreement. And you make the case, and I agree with you, that actually the compromise came because of the death of Stalin. But this erroneous belief in the Eisenhower administration helped shape the strategic concept of massive retaliation, the New York strategy. And it led the United States to threaten nuclear strikes in Indochina in 54 against Chinese forces during the two Taiwan Straits crises. So what I'm trying to lead to is that Northeast Asia emerges as a highly nuclearized space. Again, it's a very distinctive feature of the region, I think. The US deployed at that time tactical nuclear weapons to US bases in South Korea, Taiwan, Guam, Hawaii, Okinawa. And then you had China emerging as a nuclear weapons state in 64. And North Korea is undoubtedly influenced by these developments, by these threats, by this nuclearized region, seeing merits, actually, I think, in Beijing's argument for nuclear self-reliance, increased strategic autonomy, enhanced international prestige. And of course, China at that time was making the argument that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty didn't deserve to be supported. And China doesn't join until 1992, I think. So it was left to Moscow, actually, to try to persuade Pyongyang that it needed to join the treaty before the Soviets got involved with the peaceful development of nuclear energy. And I think, again, what's possibly behind my remarks here is that that Pyongyang remained convinced that nuclear weapons development made huge strategic sense, but also less convinced that things like the NPT was of advantage to it. And perhaps this explains why North Korea stands as the one state that has withdrawn from the NPT. So the nuclear threats made during the Korean War and subsequently, I think, were a very important prompts in a chain that led to the decisions by China and by North Korea to develop nuclear weapons. And of course, all of this has complicated enormously US war planning in contemporary times. I think the Korean War was consequential in a couple of other ways as well. You mentioned, Arnie, that it was costly for the PRC, let alone for Koreans themselves. Chinese lost a lot of lives. There were delays to the onset of the five-year plan and so on. You talk about that. But you also mentioned, of course, but it was a big win for China's prestige because it fought the US forces to a standstill on the peninsula. But it was also very costly in other longer term ways. And again, if I think about it, it's in a global context. It kept Beijing out of the United Nations until 1971 because Beijing and North Korea were both labeled aggressors in the war. And therefore the matter of Chinese the Beijing taking over the China seat in the UN became an important question requiring a two-thirds majority among member states. So you had the Republic of China on Taiwan representing China in the UN until 1971, and a constant reminder that the Chinese Civil War remained unfinished. So in some senses, if you like, a loss of prestige over the longer term for China with respect to the Korean conflict. North Korea and South Korea, of course, don't even enter the United Nations until 1991, which means, again, no real international UN-type involvement in this particular issue. And this negative impact on North Korean action, the North Korean action in June 1950, is actually quite often reflected in Chinese scholarship on North Korea, and particularly in periods when North Korea doesn't seem to be doing China's bidding. So particularly when it refuses to stop testing nuclear weapons in the more contemporary era, you see a bit of a rash of writing in China suggesting that North Korea's always been a burden, the millstone for China. And so when you say that at the end of the book, the North Korean is the real Korea as far as China's concerned, I mean, I think there are strong negative currents as well. I know you referenced some of these, but I was very struck by the few remarks you made in your brilliant conclusion, by the way. It's a really, really good read just on its own. North Korea somehow has a special status for China. I see it a little more negatively, I think, than you. And I think, again, if you think about the way in which China has commemorated the 70th anniversary of Chinese entry into the conflict, I thought that was, again, a fascinating period for thinking about China-Korean relations. According to Chinese commentary, during this commemorative event, the Korean War broke out. So it's not, again, it's not being accepted at Chinese official levels as North Korean attack on the South, even though, of course, Chinese scholars, again, do accept the North Korean role in the starting of the war, leaving aside the civil war elements, of course. I'm talking about the international dimensions of the war. And that the destruction suffered by Koreans didn't feature in that Chinese commemoration. And the main purpose of that commemoration was to demonstrate China's ability to prevail against the United States and force this stalemate on the peninsula, even when China was materially very weak. And it also used as a way of trying to underscore the allegedly close ties with North Korea. So close as lips and teeth comes back again. Kim Jong-un visited the grave of Mao's son during the commemoration, whereas South Korea foreign ministry issues a statement saying, exactly the same time, North Korea invaded the South. Let's get this right, mate, because that's the way the South Koreans see it. So I think the form that this commemoration took in Beijing has added to a very difficult China-South Korean-North Korean relationship in the present. And I think, have pointed that up a bit more in the book. And it was also, I think this commemoration was meant to point out that we are now at another power transition point in the East Asian region. And in this next stage of power transition, in the context of a more powerful China and the relative decline of the United States, South Korea is stuck with its familiar and very difficult bind of trying to balance between its alliance with the United States against the need to keep open channels with China that's crucial not only to Seoul's economic health. Something like one quarter of South Korea's trade is with China, but also important because it wants to advance its own policy towards North Korea. The South Koreans have an obvious desire, more powerful in some administrations than in others, but basically to maintain as much policy autonomy as possible, including for Seoul to take the lead on North Korean issues. And that is often denied to it. You made the point just now, and the book does too, public attitudes towards Beijing are not at all warm in South Korea. Some 91%, I read the other day, believing that China doesn't want to see a unified peninsula. And China's use of economic leverage over the THAAD issue also causes this real downturn in ties and in public opinion. And actually, again, I question, despite North Korea's recent statements of strong ideological links with its allegedly close ally, China, it's the way it interacted with Trump, the way it demonstrated its preference for, if you like, cutting China out of the negotiation process in those few months, well, I thought very powerful, sent very powerful signals. So what I suppose I would conclude is that the power transition, yes, is in train again from the United States to China, but it's not complete. And again, our understanding of that is aided if we focus on China-Korea relations, as you've chosen to do in this book. So a lot more to say. Thanks very much for stimulating these thoughts about the changes to regional and global order that we've been witnessing over the past 120 years or so, and in which the peninsula is really deeply implicated. Thank you very much, Ronnie.
Okay, thank you very much, Rosemary. First, for reminding us all, which needs to be reminded, about the extraordinary impact that the Korean War had, not only on the Cold War, but on the world as a whole. I always think this counterfactual argument, if it had never happened, the world might have been a very different place. You'd still had a Cold War, but it would have been a very different kind of Cold War. I think the second emphasis, or one of many, the whole question of nuclear weapons and that the whole real complex issue there, fascinating stuff. So say, what I'm going to do, we've got lots of questions, you won't be surprised to hear, which have already come in. I thought I might just have a little exchange between the three of you before I move on to the Q&A, because we've got a good half hour for the questions, and I will try and bring in everybody. Arnie, why don't you come back, I mean, you know, to both Jim or to anything you want to pick up, obviously not everything, but there's a couple of things you would like to kind of come back on and just to a few reflections on very quickly?
Absolutely, Mick. First and foremost, thanks to both Jim and Rosemary for excellent comments. I'm very grateful, deeply honored that you set off time to read the book and to comment on it. And I think you've drawn out, you know, both some of the strengths and some of the weaknesses in the book. Well, obviously, this was quite a challenging task. I mean, if it was challenging in terms of writing the book, imagine what it was like to try to cram all of this into 350-minute lectures, as it all started with. Perhaps that was the reason why they were able to persuade me in the end to write the book, because I had so much more I wanted to say, even though it's still a small book. So on the early period of the relationship, I completely agree with Jim that the relationship that I set up, the ones related to the Neo-Confucian revolutions of the late 15th century, of course, not the starting point for Sino-Korean relations. They go much further back than that. And what one could say, I think a really good summary that Jim indicated, is that if you look at this in broader sort of comparative international relations and international history framework, then you see that most of the tensions and conflicts that we are dealing with here comes out of the basic challenge of being not a small country. Korea isn't small, but a noble-sized country, a little bit more populous than Britain, living right next to a gigantic empire. I mean, that's the tension that is there. As Jim said, whatever the empire calls itself, and it's called itself by many names up to today, same entity that basically calls itself a People's Republic today, it's always been difficult to handle. Living right next door to an empire is challenging and potentially damaging to your health. And one has to admire the Koreans in terms of how they have been capable. One could say all the way up to the disasters of the 20th century to handle this relationship and to do so with massive insights. I mean, one of the things I was struck by in the early period, and this does go back beyond the somewhat artificial cutoff that I have in the late 14th century, is Korean intelligence capabilities, always knowing more about the empire than what the empire knows about them. And espionage is something that, particularly during Joseon, but even before Joseon, that Koreans specialized. Every trade mission, so-called tribute mission, going to Beijing, always had spies attached to it with very specific tasks in terms of what they needed to do, the information they needed to bring back, because Joseon's security depended on it. Rosemary's point about how difficult a death it was for the old Sino-centric system in East Asia is a really, really good one. This is something that I hadn't really thought about, even when I've been working on Chinese history, in the same way as what I did when I was working through this. It actually helps looking at imperial relations from the outside rather than from the inside, as I've done in my earlier work on China. Just how tenacious these ideas were, the hold that they had on people's minds. That China, whatever it called itself, was the center of something. And then when that starts slipping, you know, in the late 19th century for Koreans, it takes a very long time to die. And some of it is still there, as Jim pointed out. Not just for the good, but, you know, in many ways quite challenging as well. The problematic of living right next to an empire has not gone away. What's interesting that you picked up on the issue of current Chinese elite perceptions of the two Koreas, because they are so complex and it's very hard. So when I meet with US policymakers, it's really difficult to try to explain some of this relationship. Maybe particularly this idea, which also was so striking in Xi Jinping's truly remarkable 70th anniversary of the Chinese intervention in the Korean War speech. I'll return to that in a second. But this idea that the Republic of Korea, South Korea, is not genuine, that it is in a way a US implant that it's something that is artificial, that has come in from the outside, is so strongly held, in spite of many of the Chinese leaders not particularly liking, the North Korean regime or what it stands for. I last time I lived in Beijing in 2019, I was invited to the Yunshi Koshiyan, the Central Military Academy. And it was particularly striking there to see, how important it was to many mid and high ranking Chinese officers to emphasize that the North might not be China's closest ally and China's most important foreign link, but it is a genuine state. It's a genuine East Asian state, something that the South can never be. And then finally, this point that Rosemary mentioned, I think it's a really important point, and she did so fantastically well in terms of the outline. Korea as nuclearized space, and that this is not something that is just connected to the North Korean nuclear program. I think this is really important to understand. It does go back to the Korean War era. This is where the North Korean communists' idea about the only salvation for the regime being achieving some kind of nuclear capacity comes from. It doesn't grow out of nothing. This is not just an evil dictator who decides, I need nuclear weapons today to terrorize the rest of the world with them. It comes out of that particular specific setting. So I do think, that's how we've ended up in our current predicament, in this really difficult situation that we have at the moment, that it's the security needs, all sides, United States, Japan, the two Koreas and China, that drive us, certainly at the moment, in the wrong direction with regard to the situation on the Korean Peninsula. And that is why it is so dangerous as it is today.
I suppose you could add to that, Arnie, that after they saw what happened to Saddam Hussein and Iraq,
sure.
That's a triple reason for hanging on and keeping your nuclear weapons and keeping your powder dry, I would have thought. So
absolutely.
You hear
absolutely. So even if the ideas were there from earlier on, Mick.
Yeah, sure.
I do think it is, of course, the ability of the North Koreans to actually develop their own nuclear program much earlier than what most people think that has made a difference. But I think Rosemary is right in saying, in order to understand that quest, one has to understand its roots and where it comes from.
And also, if I might just add my own tuppenny worth here, in some funny way, Rosemary, it's worked. I mean, it's drawn North Korea to the center of the stage.
Yeah.
It leverage you wouldn't have had otherwise. It forced the Americans, as you discussed with Trump, or you mentioned Trump, to kind of take North Korea seriously. So, so much nonsense, old mad regime, irrational. Something that Jim, I think, would fundamentally disapprove of, and I would too. But it did work, did it not, Rosemary? I mean,
it did work. I mean, it's likely to work again, isn't it? Actually, because Biden is stuck with the usual thing of what do we do? Do we accept North Korea as a nuclear weapons state and try to prevent proliferation, or do we continue with the idea of denuclearization? That horrible word trying to impose that on North Korea, and I think very, very difficult to actually get North Korea to move towards the idea of getting rid of its nuclear weapons. And, and China's in a different place as well. I mean, I think China's at the point where it's almost accepted that, we're going to have a North Korea that has nuclear capacity, nuclear weapons capacity. It doesn't seem to be willing to use the leverage that it once was willing to use. I mean, sanctions seem to have sort of somewhat melted away. So again, we're in a very, very difficult moment where North Korea again is the center of attention, and South Korea becomes again embraced within the US alliance system, but in that sense it therefore moves, if you like, more into having its particular options shaped by the United States more heavily than where it would like to be under Moon Jae-in, in my view.
Can I've got many questions, and I'll try and keep together, if I can, and then spread them around to the three. We've had almost three questions. You can come in, Jim, and whatever you want to say, obviously, on questions of unification. Jim, you were a bit more sceptical, or at least a bit more worried, or a bit more concerned that it could happen, the conditions under which it might happen. We've had two or three questions on unification from a colleague at Sciences Po. How would it happen? Is it connected to Confucianism in any way? Is there any connection? But how do you think it could happen, Jim? Do you think it would happen? Because I detect a very obvious difference. I think a slight difference between you and Arnie on that one. I'll bring you in on that one, Jim. And anything else you want to mention, please feel free to do so.
Well, personally, I don't see Korean unification as any time likely. There are a number of reasons for that. Mm. They've been apart for quite a long time now. And just because something was once unified, even something that was unified for a long period, doesn't necessarily mean it will be again. And I think that is the state of Korea at the moment. Now, I think you could only really move on that when the whole Korean War generation, not just those who fought in the war, because they're now dying off very fast, but their children and even their grandchildren, until they've moved away from the scene, until you can get a different narrative, then I don't think there's a chance that the two Koreas will come together. And I think in both North and South Korea, the traditional attitudes towards the other are still being reinforced through education. And until that goes, until there is a willingness to accept that the other exists completely and is going to continue existing, until the education changes and the generations change, then you might be able to start talking about unification. I think Kim Dae-jung was right. Put it off. Do a Deng Xiaoping, but that is not working quite so well at the moment. But leave it to future generations. Let us come together. Let us trade. Let us exchange. Let us deal now as things are. And then one day, maybe, we can work towards unification. So I still remain very doubtful about unification. I agree entirely with Arnie that North Korea's, and indeed, I think with Rosemary, North Korea's not going to give up its nuclear weapons. Would you? I said to the North Korean ambassador in London once, how useful are they? What can you do with them? And he said, well, how useful are they to you? To which point I said, well, I don't agree with our nuclear program either. But I think that it, even if they didn't actually start working on nuclear weapons during the Korean, just after the Korean War, I suspect that they probably did, but even if they didn't, by the 1960s and the failure of the Soviet Union to come to the aid of Cuba, they were convinced that we can't depend on somebody else. We've got to do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And they were, the whole atmosphere at that point internationally was that nuclear weapons were just another weapon, they were here to stay. And nuclear power was good as well. So, everybody had nuclear things of one sort or another. I know that talking to the Russian foreign ministry back in about 1993 it would be, when I was at IISS, about this, they said, look, the North Koreans sent lots of scientists, scientific students, engineering and chemistry students here to look at nuclear matters. And we trained them very well. And they were the most conscientious students we'd ever had. They didn't party. They concentrated entirely on studying nuclear matters. Mm. When they left, they took every single textbook they could lay their hands on with them, though they weren't supposed to. And he said, we've never heard a word from them ever since. So certainly by the 1960s, they were working away at nuclear matters, maybe thinking initially in civilian terms, but I think in practice probably also the idea of having weapons would be there as well. Just one final point.
Yeah, please, Jim.
about the relationship with China. I think one of the big points to remember is the generational change, that people who actually knew each other well from, in Kim Il-sung's case, and in many of his colleagues' case, from fighting with the Chinese communists in Manchuria. Kim Jong-il was sent to China, the outbreak of the Korean War. He may have come back later, but he was there for some of his early years. Kim Il-sung certainly spoke Chinese, liked speaking Chinese. He wrote Chinese, although they stopped using Chinese characters. Inscriptions in Chinese on many buildings, old temples and so on, they're his calligraphy. There was just that, it's that strange mixture of relations and tied up. But that generation's all gone. Kim Jong-un has no interest in China as, in one sense. He has in some ways, because I think he probably admires some of the things they've done. But he hasn't got that same personal involvement. Mm. And that, I think, does actually matter.
It's also presumably, Jim, a matter of revolutionary generations. I mean, a lot of these guys grew up together in the same movement.
Yeah, they also, Kim Il-sung was part purged by the Chinese communists.
Exactly.
He's great suspicion of the
Chinese. They're all former comrades in some ways, Jim. You know?
Well, yeah. I suppose the last point I mean, would always be, North Korea is there. It may one day disappear. But I suspect not until you can guarantee to the leadership they're not going to be strung from the nearest lamppost. They do know about Saddam Hussein, and they know about Libya, even down to quite low levels in hierarchy. Until you can provide that sort of reassurance, which I suspect is only going to come when that first condition, age, takes away all those.
On just one quick point, I'll bring in other questions very quickly. I remember teaching a group of students in Geneva at the International Relations there. And there was a fairly large number of North Korean diplomats there, and they were very well informed and very sophisticated. I mean, you know, it was not the kind of cliched vision. They were well informed, they read everything you had written or I had written or somebody had written, and they really came back. It was quite impressive in the same way that you just talked about this absorption process. I've got a question coming up about, well, I've had one on Germany, which is interesting because the question of unification comes from a colleague at the GNU University in New Delhi, Pathanabhoinya Ramakrishna, if I've correctly pronounced that. It's actually, this is another unification question. What impact did the reunification of Germany and the collapse of the USSR have on all this? Arnie, I'll bring in Rosemary on this first, if you don't mind, just to reflect on that, because my memories of that are, once they saw German unification and the cost of it, that they kind of ran away from it as rapidly as possible. That was my impression at the time talking to people. Rosemary, what's your view on that?
That's my memory of it too, actually, Nick. I mean, there was great interest in the process of reunification, and there was a lot of discussion about the fact that North Korea's population is about 50% of South Korea's, whereas East Germany's population was about a quarter of, you know, of West Germany, and so on. So, and there was a sense in which the it would be far too costly for the South actually to think about this in a very similar way, and therefore you've got much more of the idea of the sunshine policy and the idea of actually trying to bring North Korea along, particularly economically, to try to sort of boost its capacities in one way or another. So, yeah, there was a great deal of interest in what had happened in Germany. On the collapse of, I don't know, Arnie would be better on this one, but on the collapse of the former Soviet Union, I mean, that obviously, in a way, I think, it was the Soviet Union, after all, that recognized South Korea in 1990. And so in some senses, there was a kind of schadenfreude, I would suggest, on the part of the North, because they felt that they had been betrayed in many ways by the Soviet Union in 1990, by China itself in 1992, as it recognized South Korea. But at the same time, it takes away certain things, doesn't it? It takes away the possibility of having two potential allies, two sources perhaps of investment and aid, another voice on the Security Council that can, you know, that's dealing with sanctions policies and so on. So there's a sort of a range of issues that the North regime would have to weigh up in the circumstances of those two big changes that you referenced, Germany and the former Soviet Union.
Do you want to come in on that one, Arnie, quickly?
Yeah, I mean, just quickly on reunification issues in general. So I generally think when I'm here or when I'm in London, and I reflect on what we are seeing on the Korean Peninsula and in the region, that any kind of meaningful move towards reunification is quite some ways off. It's only when I'm in Beijing that I'm really struck by this is being a potential for it happening sooner than what anyone thinks. And that's because the people I speak to about Korea in China, in Beijing, who are people who are pretty well informed and who work on Korean matters, both South and North, they are the ones who are telling me that the North Korean regime is not going to survive, that it's moving in the wrong direction with regard to reform. It's getting weaker, not stronger. And the implication, they don't say that, but the implication is that, you know, we will get, not move towards more of the sunshine policy, which I, in many ways, would have been happier with, right? Because this is risky business. Or the long Ostpolitik, you know, to use the German example, kind of development, preparing for unification. But that we might rather be moving towards some kind of Leipzig moment, you know, when people at some point just had enough. One thing we did learn from Germany is that it doesn't take very long. It is not a very long distance from saying we are the people in the People's Republic to saying we are one people. And then, of course, the game is up. You know, whatever we may think for strategic reasons, or even, you know, more importantly, what a lot of people in Seoul or in the South might think about. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of sense that I have of this, that, you know, in many ways, I hope that this more structured along the lines that Jim mentioned earlier on, more prepared. But I have a strong suspicion we might not get that opportunity.
Yeah. Rosemary, you want to come in there quickly and then Jim?
Just very quickly, Arnie, yeah. Just to ask Arnie whether, I mean, obviously, again, we're at a rather important inflection point, you know, that North Korea allegedly has been going through serious difficulties with COVID. Kim Jong-un is not that well established as a leader, and we see some attempts to bring his sister into the picture, which makes me wonder about, you know, his longevity, essentially, political or in terms of his own health. And then there's this extraordinary statement at the Party Congress fairly recently, where they talk about economic austerity and that the population is going to suffer over the next few years, and indeed is not going to enjoy the benefits of marketization, that they're moving away into a more centrally controlled economy and in a very austere period, but not giving up nuclear weapons. Now, all of this sounds like a recipe for disaster, doesn't it, actually? And I think if I was sitting in Beijing, I would have rather similar sentiments to those that you've outlined, that maybe, you know, for years we've talked about North Korea possibly being on the edge of collapse and, you know, and it's always survived. But again, are we at something rather particular right now? Or is it the case, as you say in the book, actually, that China still wants North Korea as a buffer state and will do anything it can to just keep it as a regime that's functioning, at least at some level? And again, I think that's...
I'm going to jump over to Jim. Jim, do you have any answer to that particular conundrum?
Jim has lived in Pyongyang and knows more about this than what I do.
Yeah, Jim.
Well, I don't know about knowing more. I know a bit more. I certainly don't think that North Korea is on the verge of collapse. I think its reaction It probably has some COVID, yes, of course, but probably not very much. That's why they close the borders. And they're very good at, if they decide that they're going to do something like that in the health field, they do it. Mm-hmm. Everybody is vaccinated. There's no good, there'll be no arguments. And if you don't turn up at the clinic, they'll come around to you and do you. So I think they were very frightened though by the whole thing, that this was going to be something that if it got in large quantities, large numbers of people ill, they couldn't cope. The health service just can't cope anymore. The difference with Germany is always, lots of people in the South looked to Germany, and they used to send lots of teams to Germany to study how it had all come about. But the Germans didn't fight a civil war. Now, Korean War is obviously much more than just a civil war, but it began as a civil war. Whoever started it doesn't matter. Both sides were quite willing to have a go to try and bring about unification. It failed, and it failed dismally because of outside intervention. And so you don't have that element at all, and you don't have the bitterness that is created by civil wars. Any civil war you think about, the divides are still there in some way. Even the Yorkist civil wars of the 15th century in Britain, there's still evidence that the division is still in the mind, it's still there somewhere. And look at Ireland, look at Spain, look at America. One of the things I think about the attack on the Capitol building was the Confederate flags being brought in and old slogans being yelled. So I think it is very different from the German case. On the question of the Chinese, the Chinese sometimes, it's a long time since I've actually talked very much to Chinese officials, and so I'm probably well out of date. But they have no illusions about Koreans, North or South. They do wax and wane sometimes about whether the North will survive. But I do think that the buffer state idea, that if South Korea were to change so that it became a completely independent state of the United States, if the American forces were to go, then, and I think the Chinese would be quite happy or quite willing to accept a United Korea. What they don't want is a United Korea that still is dominated by the influence of the United States. Now, that may change in the next 50 years as China becomes the number one in the world or whatever it does. But I think until the United States withdraws from Asia, which is going to be quite some time, I suspect, then the Chinese will want something that helps to keep the American forces a safe distance away from them, and the American pressure a safe distance away from them.
Thanks. I've got a question here from Stuart Austin, who worked with us actually in LSC Ideas. We haven't yet much talked about Japan. It's been mentioned in passing, but I wonder if any of you would like to make a reflection on that, both the historical side, Arnie, and yourself, all three of you, the longer term impact of that on Korean culture, on Korean society. And also, of course, then the Second World War. I mean, again, when my limited direct experience of Korea was, if the Chinese sometimes had some pretty negative views and images of Japan, then multiply that by about four or five when I was in South, except that the economic and the culture is kind of strange, which I found. Just like, maybe, Arnie, why don't you come in on that and your own reflections, and then around the table to Jim or Rosemary, whichever order. Arnie, what about your thoughts on that?
Well, obviously, these three relationships, particularly if you put them together, try to constitute one region, although these are immensely complex. They're driven by history, as we have outlined in this session. They are not less problematic now than what they've been, in my view, at any point since the Second World War ended. There are many reasons for that, and the the current dislocation, Rosemary referred to this, that is created by the relatively rapid strengthening of China versus everyone else on a global scale. But imagine what it is to living right next to the reinvigorated empire, both in Korea and in Japan. And then, of course, there is, on the Korean Peninsula, the long historical memory, which I pointed out in my introductory remarks, of Japanese occupation and colonization. I think that's the essential aspect in many ways of Korean history. And it can be said that that relationship for Korea does two things, for both Koreas. It fuels the intensity of nationalism that we already talked about. But it also tells elite Koreans and ordinary Koreans that one has to be very careful, that the world is still a very, very dangerous place, that Japan still has ambitions with regard to the region that would be detrimental to what nationalist Koreans would want to see. Right? So that does influence, I think, particularly today for government in Seoul, very much the way they look at China and look at the relationship with the United States as well. They do not want to move back into a situation where Japan would be seen as benefiting from dissension within Korea, but also a rising conflict, which might seem to be on the cards between South Korea and China. From a Japanese perspective, which we also shouldn't forget, the situation is deeply frightening. No one is more afraid of North Korean nuclear weapons than what the Japanese are, who are, after all, the only people in history that have been the victims of a nuclear attack in anger, you know, at the end of the Second World War. So I do think that is genuine. It's something that all Japanese leaders have to build into their policies. And it is now influencing to a very high extent not just Japanese policy towards the Korean Peninsula, but also Japanese policy towards China. I mean, the idea that the Chinese are somehow responsible for the threats that come out of North Korea are very, very striking in Tokyo. And it was very interesting to see that while this almost sensational speech that Xi Jinping gave on the 70th anniversary of the Chinese intervention in Korea was mainly ignored or just referenced here. It was put on the front page of Japanese newspapers under sort of wartime headlines. Because what he says in that speech is that what we did in 1950 was entirely right. It was preventing the United States from dominating our region. We are now prepared to do the same again, wherever that is needed. We will reunify our country by force, if necessary, and we will protect Korea from coming under American hegemony. You know, it's pretty sensational stuff. It's very interesting that it hasn't, I don't think there still is a full English translation of that whole speech.
That's very interesting. Rosemary, do you want to come in on that or any other point?
Just a couple of quick points, and Arne's covered it really well. I mean, obviously, the things that sort of struck me about it is that sort of the dualistic nature of this Korea-Japan-China relationship in the sense that, you know, the Korea-Japan ties obviously are extraordinarily hostile on a number of fronts. And as South Korea, Japan, as alliance partners, they don't come together. They won't share intelligence. They won't actually do joint operations. They won't do this, that, and the other. And so this is a sort of this amazing division that has lasted such a very long time, despite being under this particular security framework. But on the other hand, the paradox here is that there are a number of parallels in their policies. I mean, there are parallel developments. So, for example, you have South Korea introducing what it describes as a southern policy, actually trying to play a larger role in Southeast Asia. You have Japan actually similarly, in strategic terms, not just in economic terms, trying to play a role in enhancing the maritime capacities of the states of Southeast Asia, or thinking about the Quad and the like. You have the two of them equally disturbed by the, you know, the 70th anniversary developments. It's on the front page in South Korea, it's on the front page in Japan. So there's this interesting sort of duality, I think, whereby on the one hand you have this intense nationalism and hostility related to the historical record predominantly, and yet you have these real parallel developments in contemporary strategic terms that actually bring them into a different space, into a sort of a shared space.
Jim, anything on this?
Me, to the North Korean Foreign Ministry. America is your worst enemy, isn't it? Reply. America's been our enemy for 100 years. Japan has been our enemy for 1,000 years. South Korea, same, you get the same sort of message officially. But on the other hand, when we lived in South Korea and you couldn't import Japanese books and so on, you went down to Busan and every television aerial was turned towards Japan because that's where the fashion came from. And the designers went down there to pick this up. It's very complex. Again, you know, there's nothing simple. I suppose my line always, when people say, oh, Japan and South Korea should work together because of their common interests, I would say you forget history at your cost. The history doesn't go away, and it's not just the colonial period. That's the worst thing in recent years, but it's also the past and the Hideyoshi invasion, and you go on and you go on. Japan is seen as a real local dangerous threat. Remember the reaction of the South Koreans when the Japanese, I think it was probably Abe, Japanese Prime Minister, said that they might have to send troops in to rescue Japanese citizens if there was an attack from the north. Ah, yeah. That would, that set cat among pigeons in a big way. I don't really see a triple alliance involving Japan, Korea, and Japan working very well.
Okay. We've actually run out of time. And moreover, even though we've got a lot more questions, and I do apologize to those who've asked questions, try to get through most of them. I think also, Arnie, you've got to go off to probably yet another Zoom meeting because your day has just started and ours is just coming to an end. So I'm going to draw our wonderful conversation to a conclusion. Firstly, to thank you, Arnie, and to congratulate you on your new book. And we're also looking forward to more lectures from you as the Engelsberg professor here. Arne is giving the lectures here on empires, and which he's become a great fan recently, at least a great historical fan, if not a fan in political terms, Arne, I have to add. Jim, thank you so much for your great insights. I've heard you talk before, by the way, on this, and it's actually fantastic. You are an expert, and I refuse not to call you one, okay? And Rosemary, very nice to see you again. The last time we met, this goes back to Arne, the last time we met actually, I think, was in Oslo some time ago at a Nobel Institute forum. I may have been even on China, actually. The peaceful rise of China? Do you remember?
That was, I do remember, yes.
So it's great meeting you, Jim, probably for the first time. And great to say hello again to Arne and Rosemary. Thanks to all the people in LSE Ideas for putting this on. Thank you to Dave Sutton, to Lucas, to Gideon and others. LSE Ideas, as you know, does a great job on these things. Thanks to the LSE, and thanks to all those people out there who listened in or watched this video. And again, I thought that was great. I learned a great deal, and I hope you all did too. So I'll say farewell. Have a good morning, Arne, or we're going to have a good evening here down in Clapham or up there in North London or up there in Oxford. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye, Jim. Bye, Rosemary. Bye, Arne.
Bye.
Cheers.